It's Wednesday, February 29th, 2012, and you're listening to episode 259 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 58 minutes.
Hello and welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Pat.
My name's Chad.
This is Johan.
My name is John.
And this is the second episode we're recording tonight, so we explained why Dan isn't here before, so if you want to hear that one, either listen to another episode or not. He's sick. He'll be back sometime. Don't worry about it. It's all right. Don't worry about it.
I think we should have just told them all that this was a next week and that Dan's been sick and confined to his room for an entire week.
I think that's funnier.
He's under quarantine. I can stop and we can remember. So Dan's still under quarantine.
I heard something about them referring to him as patient zero. I don't know.
I think he even wrote about it on his on the Facebook. About, CDC, patient zero.
Facebook.
I did that on purpose.
I know you did. I heard the scorn. Yeah.
You hate Facebook so much.
I really do.
And it's not that you hate Facebook. You hate social networking.
I am sort of annoyed by the social networking. Yeah.
I'm right there with you. I just,
for me, it's a specific type of loathing. And it's basically that I don't like that it has become the primary means of communication for a lot of people with their friends. It's one thing to be just sort of a thing where they can go on there and say, oh, this is great. Look what so-and-so is doing. But when it becomes literally the only way that some people communicate with their other friends, as opposed to picking up a phone and talking to them.
You have to remember,
I just don't like
it. I have different levels of friends, right? Mm-hmm. I have you guys whom I see face-to-face all the time, and I don't have a problem picking up the phone and calling you, and we communicate socially online all the time via the forums and email and see each other face-to-face, so that's a level of friends. But I also have several other levels of friends, too. Like, I have people that I was friends with and knew in high school that we've kind of gone, a life has taken us our separate ways, and we are able to reconnect over Facebook. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it a relationship. But they know about me and I know about them and I can catch up on their life. And then occasionally I'll say something stupid and they'll say something pithy, or they'll say, hey, there's this movie coming out. And I could say, hey, remember, this is the sequel to that movie that we saw back when we were in high school. Oh, yeah.
I'll see their horrible breakup in my status feed and send them a consoling message with a time and a place.
I mean, like I said, there you go. That's right, John. I like how you think, my brother.
I don't actually do that.
Yeah.
Or do I?
But again, I understand this completely, and I see the value in that for what it is, mm-hmm. and I agree with you on that. But I will say this, though. As much as I hate Facebook, I have
MySpace.
I have a much deeper...
Wayne loves MySpace. He loves it.
And where is Wayne?
He's at home on MySpace.
No,
but I try to open his profile, and the Diary of Jane just played like so loud.
If I hate Facebook, then I have a fear and loathing hatred of Twitter. Is
but
beyond
we really
all
need
measures.
To know about everyone's ham sandwich.
Well, that's the thing. Facebook, I get. I understand it. I get it. I have my own personal things with it.
You don't care for
but
it.
But Twitter, my God, what the hell?
See, I don't dislike Twitter. I don't understand Twitter. I don't grok it. I don't get it.
I don't get it because you can't play music on your page. I miss that so much.
I've tried so hard. John Greta blowing up fireworks all over the background.
You have followers, but you can't arrange them in your top eight.
Yeah, there's no top eight. How will I understand my place in the social strata of humankind without a top eight?
Yes.
If my top eight ratio, if I'm not in more than eight people's top eight, that's just reciprocation. It's not even popularity. I hate it.
All righty. Well, on that note, and we'll post this on Facebook. But anyway.
So what are your feelings on LinkedIn?
I have a LinkedIn account.
I don't have one.
I remember when that first came out, I had several people sending it to me to try to get to join. I'm like, yeah, I have a job. I'm fine. I don't need it.
You know what's funny about LinkedIn? And I hope Chris listens to this because I haven't actually been able to tell them. I think Chris uses like some sort of app or something that when he makes a tweet or a Facebook post or something like that.
Or a G+ post.
G+ post.
All of which he does multiple times a day.
He either hits all of these sites and posts the same thing on all these sites, or he has an app, which he, this is probably what it is, that blasts them out to all of these sites. So I have LinkedIn, and I get email updates of people who change stuff, and the updates I get is so-and-so added this company, so-and-so friended this person, or joined them to their network, so-and-so updated their resume, Chris Hussey, I went down to the beach today with my kids. It was great. I'm writing a serial fiction. Man, I did 300 reps and I got a huge boner out of it.
That's you know like, what? That's all it is. It's clips of a serial fiction and how much weight he lifted. I have to be at the gym in 26 minutes after I write my serial fiction.
Those are appropriate things for Twitter. Some of them are appropriate, in my estimation, on Facebook. None of them are appropriate on LinkedIn because LinkedIn is like potentially getting a new job, professional, putting himself out there.
But he considers short fiction and fitness
his
subsidiary job.
Yeah. But he will also post stuff like I did 200 reps and I got a
Well, he's into personal training.
You know, and on another thing.
Half of the reason those guys train as they get older is to keep their boners going.
Yeah.
That's all the reason Chris does. Talk to him about it.
No, I refuse.
Okay.
But I also see it as maybe a good thing, too, because it shows his personality, whereas all these other people are just like, I am robotic. Here are my list of skills. Here are my connections. Hire me, please. Chris, you know, if you go to Chris's LinkedIn page, it's very real. You really get an essence of who and what Chris is and what he's all about. And, you know, that could definitely give him a leg up. Especially in some of the things that he's trying to do with his life.
And Chris has always struck me as being a very boisterous and upfront person.
Yes, yes,
I mean, he's the one who took BattleTech books to a job interview.
Yes.
So
I took Altered Carbon to a job interview, but it was on an e-reader, so nobody could tell that I was reading about clones having sex on drugs.
No, he brought the BattleTech books as part of his resume.
He handed
them to him and said, here's my technical writing skills.
Okay, I didn't know that.
There you go.
You know, fair enough on the technical writing skills. That's actually a pretty good idea.
That's a technical readout.
Yeah.
Strong.
All right, some announcements.
Strong like Chris's manhood after he does 100 reps.
I want to see Chris lift you over his head, John. I want to see that. He's such a skinny little guy. I've given the man a hug. He's really solid.
Yeah.
He's built.
He's very strong.
I bet he could throw me.
I felt the bulge.
I bet
anyway,
you did.
So announcements. Fear the Con coming up in May.
Yes, Mars needs GMs.
That's right, Mars.
Run
that's
more
right.
games.
Mm-hmm. What is it? It's Fear the Con of Mars.
Yes,
there we go.
And so, as far as we can tell, since recording the last episode, not one GM has signed up.
That's true. I don't know what you guys are doing, but you're slacking.
It has been an hour and 30 minutes since we have started the last episode we recorded, and not one new game.
I'm very not disappointed. One. Very. Disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
See, you don't want me to be disappointed in you.
Johan, this is how time travel works. This is how it really works.
Is this the box in the box thing?
Yeah, the primer.
Right. I forgot what the game I was going to run was.
Fear and Loathing.
You're the problem.
No, the other one.
Oh, crap. I didn't.
There was one we thought of. Like,
it was really cool.
Not even an hour ago.
Oh, my God. You'll have to listen to
it. But it was a week ago. Yeah.
This time travel crazy. Somebody's going to get on the forums and remind you in 2 weeks
I know.
What this thing you forgot was an hour and a half.
And I'm not going to run it anyway because
if it wasn't
I'm
that
running
memorable.
Two already and I've been in the Magic Tournament and the BattleTech Pounder out and probably going to go to the podcaster thing. And
you know, there's a guy on Facebook who he wrote me a very nice message and I never responded to him. And he was like...
It's because it was Facebook.
Because I'm a heartless jerk, I guess, but... He was saying he really likes my style of gaming. He's a fan of the show, and he really likes the show. And he really, really wants to be in one of my games. And he was specifically asking me to run a game in the first slot so he could specifically get in on it. So I have one game up. I'm going to put another one in the first slot for him, even though I haven't told him yet. Again, past, future, time travel. It's awesome. And... I'm thinking about a third. I don't know. I'm in a lot of games.
I have signed up for a couple. I need to go back out there and see what's available and update that as
Pat,
well.
You need to blow your con cherry. Mm-hmm. You need to run a game.
Ooh.
I do too, and I will probably once again not get around to doing it.
You cowards.
The essence of
theatrical. I am cowardly and lazy, sir.
Well,
I think it's equal parts.
I'm not lazy insofar as I'm running something I designed anyway for a published product. Mm-hmm. So it counts as original. I just don't have to make anything extra. It's the best of both worlds. Yeah.
Fair enough.
That's see, if deal. Only I could dig up that module I wrote when I was 10, I could run it.
That, I'm sure, would be awesome.
I bet it would. I bet it's on 5 1/4 floppy somewhere, so.
Not an insurmountable problem.
Not at all. I've got a 486 in my parents' basement that could run floppy. That thing like a dream.
You need Cialis? What?
What? No, you just need to do 300 refs at 120 pounds.
Yeah.
Oh my god, I can't believe they're talking about that. It's so crude.
I'm sorry.
You are crude.
Anyway. So, GMs. So, GMs, get out there, put your games up on there on Con Planner.
Yes.
Players, get out there and sign up for those games, and we will see you at Fear the Con 5. Fear the Con 5, the last. That's horrible. That's scratch that. Whatever. But anyway.
Yeah, we are thinking about like a Mayan Into the World theme.
That's what I meant. There won't be anything else.
Yeah.
Come December. That's it. It's all she wrote, folks. I mean, we've only been talking about this for the last 2 years.
Banks, yeah. So party,
this
cheese,
cannot
cake,
be
jelly,
a surprise
bean,
for anybody at this point. If it is, well, that's just sad. Sad. So, anyway.
Go to the next topic. Control your show.
What is it? Wait, I control the show. So, fantasy writing.
Mm-hmm.
Love it or hate it?
I don't really care for it. I'm more of a sci-fi guy than anything else, although I don't really read science fiction anymore. I kind of transitioned over into like literature, and then I transitioned over into like memoirs, and now I've transitioned over into I'm reading lots of legends, myths from other countries. That's kind of what I'm into now.
Mm-hmm.
But back when I was a teenager, yeah, it was like solid science fiction. I don't really care for Tolkien-esque fantasy. I like Tolkien. I love The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
Hobbit is a really good book that I loved a lot. And then I tried to read Lord of the Rings. I made it to the end of the second book, and then I just got so sick of all the camping and bitching about
camping.
Oh,
so you stopped at the best part, because if you make it through the slog, the marathon slog that is the Two Towers,
there's not that much description of walking and camping in the Lord of the Rings.
Oh, my God, and they just bitch and bitch and bitch about the camping.
Okay, they whine about the fact that they're cold and starving and walking straight into the den of hell.
Mm-hmm.
But you would,
for 150 pages, though.
Yeah.
I will give that to you.
And I would whine for 150 pages if I have to walk to Wentzville.
I and John and I are Tolkien purists. We love our Tolkien.
That's right.
But I will concede to you that The Two Towers is a painful stretch of reading, especially if you're not into it like I am.
You know, Two Towers has the scene where the orcs fight each other.
Oh, I read the books, and I've read Two Towers multiple times, and I don't look at it as a labor to read it. But for those of you that are like, if you're reading it for the first time, if you're interested in doing it, you're like, I'm going to read the Lord of the Rings because it's hip now, and I'm going to do it. You're going to get to that book. You're going to sit and you're going to hit that book and you're like, oh my god, this is boring.
Once they start going toward Mordor, just flip to the end of Two Towers, pick up Return of the King.
No. See, read it all and love it.
Absolutely.
See, here's my thing. Here is why the camping was worse than what it actually is. All the bits with Strider and Gimli and Legolas and Merry and Pippin and Treants and you know, the running and finding the orcs.
They're called Ents.
Oh, Ents, sorry. Treants.
It was an Entmoot.
There was an Entmoot.
And all the Ents.
It was very quick ones.
Well. All this sort of stuff was a rollicking adventure. It was very fun, and I loved it. It was very adventurous and gung-ho, and I really got into the characters and the story and all that sort of stuff. And it was like, action, 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 cool stuff. Stop. Oh my God, Master Frodo, we have to camp and it's raining and I hate camping. Potatoes. And, you know, it's just going on and on.
He's such a slinker, Mr. Frodo.
And then it's just
non-canonical potatoes.
Exactly. It's a brace of conies.
There's only Lembas bread and a brace of conies.
Yes.
And it was such a slog. And then
there's only one way to
it would end, and then you're back to the action and the adventure and the good story and all the good dialogue and all the cool stuff, and you're really getting into it, and then all of a sudden, nope, stop. Oh my god, camping sucks. I hate camping. Oh, we have to walk and we don't wear shoes.
Did you just say that the potatoes were non-canonical?
I say the potatoes are non-canonical.
You are incorrect, sir.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. He doesn't actually get potatoes, but he does discuss them.
He may discuss, but they made I think we were getting at
the
more
specific
is the
potatoes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's non-canonical. Because he refers to them as chips.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, you're, that's
obviously, taters. I hear that.
Taters.
And Gollum says, taters, what's your filthy taters?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's taters, precious?
That's right. So there you go.
Give me fish. Keep nasty chips. Anyway.
Fresh and
yes, I'm currently in the process. When I was a little kid, my dad read The Lord of the Rings to us. And
nice.
So I'm carrying on the tradition with my kids, and I'm reading it to them. Mm-hmm. And it is taking a very long time. and we just finished The Two Towers. Well, not just finished. We actually finished The Two Towers probably about 6 months ago. And the last half of The Two Towers was enough that nobody really wanted to keep going too much after that.
That's
a shame. Frodo was alive and in the hands of the enemy. Is that not the best pacing ending of any of the novels?
No.
In fact, any novel ever.
I was kind of hoping that Frodo would get his throat slit so we'd get back to the real story.
I
have to admit.
I don't know if I can sit here with these.
I have to admit.
This is disgusting.
It is.
What's the giant spider?
She daughter of Ungoliant.
Yeah.
Okay, that was really cool.
Yes.
That was.
Yeah.
I like that part.
Whether she lived or died, this tale does not say.
Mm-hmm. Is that in Two Towers?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Okay, so I probably read that part. And when I see it in my mind's eye, I, of course, transpose the movie on top of it. And so that's kind of what I see.
Yeah.
I used to transpose the big spider villain from Super Mario RPG, which is kind of comical and claymation-y. I'm better with the movie version.
That's like Dune. You know, whenever I read a Dune book, it is Kyle MacLachlan is Paul Muad'Dib. And that movie was not... Obviously, you know, the movie strayed way off the ranch, and there's all kind of problems with it. I enjoyed the movie for what it was, but it wasn't Dune. Kyle MacLachlan nailed Paul Atreides perfectly.
Well, and
his name was a killing word.
Sting nailed Fate Wrath of Harkonnen.
I agree with that as well.
Yes. I know he did.
I'll buy that. Yeah.
And then he ran across fields of barley before he lost his faith in you.
That's true.
But he didn't stand so close to the Fremen.
I have had that with characters like what you said. For me, mm-hmm. so I saw Dune way before I ever read the books. Paul is Kyle MacLachlan.
Yeah.
I had the same thing happen to me with the Jack Ryan. Alec Baldwin is Jack Ryan, although he only played him in one of the movies that were ever made. You know, Harrison Ford was in the next several
that was
much better.
That was very jarring
for me. It was to me, too, because it's like, boom, boom. It's like, oh, my God, these two, you know, not even in any way similar.
You were like, this business will get out of hand and we will be lucky to live through it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you're talking about like Hunt for Red October, and you're talking about Patriot Games,
yes.
Clear and Present Danger. Yeah.
And then Some of All Fears was another Jack.
And you know, I haven't seen it. It was not Matt Damon, his buddy.
Ben
Affleck. Ben Affleck.
Ben Stiller. hey, guys. The premiere is invading Chechnya.
But that's the thing.
Is this a school for ants?
I was a real... for me, in late high school and in college, I was a huge Tom Clancy fan.
Cochran was
I read all of the original Jack Ryan books and loved them.
Yeah.
And I was a... You know, unfortunately, I saw the movie Hunt for October first. Then decided I've got to read these books. So for me, I read them, and it was always Jack Ryan as Alec Baldwin.
Those movies aren't even sequels. Yeah. I mean, like thematically,
they're all self-contained.
It's like you shouldn't really watch them as if they are sequels.
Oh no, and that's the thing. I watched the original. I think I watched the first three or four Clancy movies. The last one I saw was, I believe, it wasn't Some of All Fears. Clear and Present Danger. I remember this because the best character that Tom Clancy has ever written is the first time you actually see him in the movies and in the books is in Clear and Present Danger. They destroyed the character in the movie, and I was so pissed. I never watched another one. It's John Clark, the character Snake, and a wonderful actor did him. It was Willem Dafoe actually plays him in the movie, but it's a horrible representation
of
that character.
Good cast for those films.
They did, but Willem Dafoe was wonderful. I love the guy, but he was a horrible John Clark. And I mean, the way they portrayed him in that movie was just horrible. And I was like, I was so offended by it. I almost wanted to leave the movie, but I never watched another one since. So I haven't seen like the Ben Affleck one either.
Yeah, I watched Hunt for the Red October, and I loved the movie, but I was never once tempted to read the books.
They're much better, like with many movies.
Especially at that point in time, all I read was fantasy novels. So,
yeah.
And as close as Hunt for the Red October is to a fantasy novel, and it's not quite there.
Not at all.
The only Tom Clancy book I ever read was Rainbow Six, because I played the video game, and I really enjoyed the video game. And then I found out, hey, it's Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six. There was a guy I worked with, and he was like, he read all the Tom Clancy books and stuff. And he's like, oh my God, you've got to read them, and you got to read them all in order, and you got to read this. And I'm like, well, I think I'll just stick with Rainbow
Six. You have to really like that kind of book to read them. I read them all. I read Rainbow Six. I enjoyed Rainbow Six because, again, this was it was focused on John Clark and his team. So for me, that was
Ding
great.
Chavez.
But yeah, Ding and
I have never read these books, but Ding Chavez is so OP in the video games that I'll remember him.
And he is. Yeah. And that's the thing. He was
the book.
He's OP in the books, not as OP as John Clark is. But by the time you meet John Clark in those, he's more like the general sitting behind things. But
they talk about him going to the pistol range and running through a box of ammo to practice. And he's considering quitting the spy game and becoming an Olympic pistol shot because he's that good at shooting.
Yeah.
And then he's like, no, I need to save the country.
Sounds like a Marty Stew, man.
Yeah.
Sounds like we need Fantasy Hunt for Red October.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hated Rainbow Six all 20 minutes that I played
Moth of Sauron.
It was awful.
I enjoyed it back in the day.
After about the 87th time in that 20 minutes that one of my teammates shot the hostage somewhere totally off screen and, oh, mission failed. Out the window it goes.
Yeah. God, I hate hostage missions. All of them.
My problem with Rainbow Six, the original Rainbow Six, now they've remade them and they're totally different nowadays, but my problem with Rainbow Six is that you had a squad, you had a team of guys, and it wasn't like you jumped into the game and you go and you do your mission, you're sneaking through and you're shooting people and they're following you and you're issuing commands. No, you're looking at an overhead map and you are drawing their walking path through the whole thing. And then you're programming them too. Your program's like, okay, when you get to this quarter, stop. Go on Overwatch. Look this way. Okay, this guy will go and pass you and then go. It's like, okay, this team go. This team go. This team. You spent like an hour and a half planning your mission, and then the mission took 3.5 minutes to complete.
Right. Wow.
And it
sounds like a date.
Yeah.
Yeah, I accept that sort of thing in an RPG, but not in a video game.
Yeah, I'm not going to sit here and defend original Rainbow Six. I enjoyed it for what it was back in the day. I don't think I'd ever play it again.
Mm.
It was really cool. It was the first video game I ever saw where I was able to take out a pistol and shoot somebody in the leg, and they had a little bullet wound right where I shot them. Now, they didn't, like, go down or scream in pain or anything, but...
So I think what we can take away from all of this is that fantasy novels are great, and...
As long as the author's name rhymes with A.R.R. Bolkin, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever read any Fritz Lieber? Like, pre-Tolkien fantasy?
No. I did.
And not even
I read
the
chapter in Deities and Demigods.
Yeah, D&D had a whole module and thing on him.
No, Chad, you and I both have read I was actually going to look up the spelling because... I remember this from before. It's either Lieber. It might be Fritz Lieber.
Lieber.
Because it's a German name. If it's Leiber, then it's Lieber. It
I'm sorry. We're in America. We have the nukes. We win.
Okay.
Fritz Lieber.
But anyway, I have read the Fritz. What's unfortunate about like the Lieber books is, or the Lieber books, whatever have you, is that they're pretty much out of print.
Yes. I think they reprinted them a couple of years ago.
Oh, did they?
And I bought them.
I know for me, I own copies of all of his books, but I literally had to get them from like a secondhand store or used bookstore.
The cool thing about the reprints, Mike Mignola did the covers.
Oh,
so awesome. He's the comic book artist who does Hellboy.
Mm-hmm.
And he also did a Fritz Lieber or a Lankmar, which is what Pat and I are talking about. That's the story. Mm-hmm. He did a Lankmar comic book, and I bought
Got the first several issues of that.
I have the trade paperback. I have the whole thing.
Cool.
It's one of his early works, so I'm a huge Mike Mignola fan, and I have almost everything he's done, except, like, I think he did, like, Swamp Thing for a bit. I don't have anything like that, but it's his early work, and you can kind of tell it's early, and the writing wasn't exactly very tight on it, and he's still developing his art style in it, but it's good. It's a good read nonetheless.
If you're looking for some fantasy like that in the sort of the pre-Tolkien vein, I definitely would check out Fritz Leiber.
Yeah,
good stuff. The Fawkford and the Grey Mouser.
Yep.
It's a very different style of writing. I mean, this is
it's
a collection of short stories. Each book that he has, they're short books. Each book is like maybe a couple hundred pages long, but each of those books is a collection of four or five short stories about the characters.
It's nothing like Tolkien. It's not a medieval knights in armor fantasy. That's sort of an English Viking tale. It is like this sort of ancient pseudo-industrial Greek thing going on with a lot of Cthulhu ancient ones thrown into it.
Yeah. And the two main characters are a couple of vagabonds. I mean, they're thieves.
Yeah.
They're anti-heroes, as it were. So, and they're always being put upon by their past.
Yes.
They're always being chased by their past and nothing really goes very well for them.
I think if you find the reprints, I think the first one is called Ilmet and Lankmar.
Good stuff. Yeah, very excellent. Good stuff. All right, well, let's move on to our main topic now, since we tried and failed last time maybe to do this.
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know that we had to admit that, because I don't think we even mentioned it last time that we had to
bring it back.
Mentioned what?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Travel.
If you don't go into the time bucket and kill Lavos, the minute you get the allowed to, after you get the fourth party member, you're a wimp.
I like that mouth. Yes. Okay. All right. So
good luck with that. I guess I was a wimp.
Our topic for today is going to be talking about
Lavos.
How wrong Chad is.
Well, that's every week.
Okay. All right.
But
we need to be more specific.
More specifically, gotcha. How is Chad completely wrong about realism and role-playing?
Pat, my opinion is that Dune is a good book, and so is Fritz Leiber. Am I wrong about this?
No, you're not.
Well, see, I'm not always wrong. Oh, well.
Damn it! Continue.
But you didn't give an opinion about a role-playing game.
All right, so realism and role-playing. How much is too much, or how much is too little? What kind of realism are we looking for in a role-playing game?
Well, my personal opinion is easily answered by starting with how much is too much. It becomes too much when it detracts from the fun of the game. How much is enough? Exactly 1 micron less than how much is too much.
So you
that's
like
the ideal balance.
So I was gonna say, so you really like to push that line. There's no like a large middle ground for you.
Yes. And I should clarify, I'm not actually talking about realism when I say that per se. What I'm talking about is internal consistency.
Yes.
I don't care about realism in most of my gaming settings because most of my gaming settings aren't the real world. If people are whipping out Vorpal swords and fighting dragons, realism is obviously out the window to begin with. However, if action A initiates consequence B, then action A should also initiate consequence B next time it happens.
I have to 100% agree with Johan. I think that
everybody mark your calendars.
Realism, I don't want to say it's totally unimportant, but it's not really that important. I think it kind of depends on your setting. It is exactly how Johan said it. It is internal consistency. When you're making a story, a world within a game, anything like that, you are making a box. You're defining the world in this box, and then even the unknown stuff that the players don't know are still within that box. They just don't know it. Your internal consistency has to remain inside that box. It can't go outside of it, because then you start throwing the rules out the window, like the rules of what you can and can't do, the rules of what can and cannot happen. You start going into Salvador Dali land. If we're playing a dark and gritty, realistic urban fantasy or something where, you know, you can kind of cast a spell and then there's werewolves and all of a sudden a Dragon Ball Z character comes out of the sky and throws the moon at you.
He's over 9,000!
What, 9,000? There's no way that can be right. Can it?
And that happens. And then suddenly you're not playing that anymore. Suddenly you're playing this different thing that isn't defined anymore. And it throws, you know, your connection to the game off.
I think as an addition, and probably something that hits a little bit closer to home with what you were getting at when you brought this topic up originally, I think in order to properly express that internal consistency, detail helps. And that's, I think, where things can really start to break down, is the more detail you add, the more you can receive the buy-in, the more you can get absorbed into this world, the more you can understand the consistencies in it. However, the easier it becomes to mess those consistencies up.
Yes, absolutely. The more you layer it on, the more you're going to forget certain little details or certain little things like that. And then that affects the truth of the world a bit. And I think that when you deal with a game, like a role-playing game, you have to not be at 100% with the accuracy of your details. And I think the players need to not call you on being at 100% of the accuracy of the details. I think it needs to be high, but it can't be 100% because the game is going. You got all these actions. You got all these, this whole table of people. You're trying to run your story. You're trying to run the world. You're trying to run the NPCs. The players are all doing different things. And if you accidentally drop a detail or make a mistake, you either have to
campaign
stop.
Over.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to do campaign over. I mean,
GM seat forfeited.
You are voted off GM Island. And the players kind of have to realize that. You know, you don't want to be that player who goes, stop, wait, you said 19 months ago that the FTL drive actually worked like this. Now you're saying it works like that.
I am that player, unfortunately. Yeah. I hate to break it to you.
But I
can understand your point. Yeah. You know, you're absolutely right. There is a point where the details become so overwhelming that they're difficult to keep track of. However, I think that it just claws at my eyes when a DM will do that and make a sort of mistake like that if it impacts things in a meaningful way. You know, if the difference between how the FTL drive works now and how the FTL drive worked 19 months ago is the difference between whether or not we escape from the invading alien army, that's a problem.
Yeah, I think that you kind of need to weigh that as a player in your mind of saying, this is really going to screw us or hell, even help us because it's helping you in an unfair way. You know?
Oh, yeah. I'll call them on things that help us, too.
Oh, yeah. If it's something big and huge, yeah, it's okay to decide, hey, wait a minute. I thought this and this. If it's quick and you can get it out and it's cool. If it's something that is unimportant, though, and doesn't affect things, you know, maybe you can pull them aside later.
Yeah. You let it slide at the table.
Yeah.
You bring it up after the GM says, all right, good game, guys. Good night. Then you say, oh, by the way, hey,
that
dude,
FTL drive
I think you messed up that FTL drive thing because it used to be like this. Which way is it?
And the GM should be like, oh, crap. Sorry about that. Let's just kind of hand wave that and move on. And then we'll go with whatever works.
Right.
You know, the truth of it.
And I think that this really gets at why I am very uncomfortable with your style of DMing and why I would never want to try to run a game that way, because I don't think I can track all that. Yeah. You know, when I sit down and I run a campaign, I've got a document and that document has the world truths in it. And so I know this is the organizations that are involved. These are what they all do. These are who the leaders are. This is what their personalities are. These are the places people are going to be. I've got it all there. I know I'm not going to be messing it up because I can always look at my paper, go, all right, his name is Jim Bob, and move on from there.
I'm not going to be so egotistical and say that I never drop details. I'm human. Everybody does it.
Mm-hmm.
But my problem isn't that I forget how the world works. My problem is I forget all the proper nouns. I don't know people's names. I don't know their dates. I don't know. Sometimes sequences of events, I get them confused. But what I do is while I don't plot out a story and write it all down and then go off my notes and have all that, I do have a notebook. Mm-hmm. And my notebook is generally empty. And then I put chicken scratch in it. If the guys run into a innkeeper or whatever, and the innkeeper comes forward, and I have to write his name down. If I don't write his name down, I'm not going to remember his name. And so I have to write that down. But the thing is, too, is that to me, when I run a game, the world is like a simulation. I understand how the world works. And I am just presenting to you this mechanism that is running. And if I don't understand how the world works, I can't present that to you.
Right.
The names and details of the little cogs and sprockets, I might not know, and that's the stuff I write down. once you guys are plugged into this mechanism that is the world and it is working and I have this understanding of it and you guys are plugged into it and it's going and going and going, that's where improv comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Then I start improvising and I start like adding things to the mechanism and I start adding things that don't necessarily run the world, so to speak,
yeah,
but are part of it. And it just goes, and that's like the story in the game you guys are playing. And that's just improv stuff that I come up off the cuff, off the top of my head. The thing is that the improv stuff has to pass through the machinery of the world. If it cannot operate within that machinery, if it cannot pass through the machine as it should, then I don't or shouldn't put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm improvising something, that doesn't mean that I pull it out of left field and just throw it in there. This means that I have this working understanding of the world and this other part, this situation, this encounter, this conversation, this whatever that I'm off the cuff throwing out there,
mm-hmm,
must be internally consistent. It must be. It must work to my understanding of the world. Because if it doesn't, I cannot put it out there. I can't. It's like you, where it scratches at your eyeballs and it just drives you crazy. It's just like, I can't do that because it's not part of that machinery.
You know, I put that way, I don't think we necessarily approach things all that much differently.
Right.
I just have a much more detailed blueprint at the start of the machine, you know,
yeah.
And that's, I will throw things out, add improv details as things mm-hmm. go along.
Sure.
I think everyone has to.
That's GM
successfully
right there.
GM.
Yeah, if you don't improv anything all the way through one game sit down, something is wrong.
Yeah. Well, or you're running a module reading box text, whether the module's in your mind or the module is on paper.
Yeah. Or you're having one long combat. I've had sessions like that where basically the session started off in a combat scenario almost, and the combat took 6 hours.
I misjudged things. I punched a guy's face off in one of those, where it was the whole session was one.
The GM or one of
no, the... was it? It was actually in the game. It was pretty. It was that's how these guys gamed. I sat in on a game one time, mm-hmm. and it was just, you know, round one, and the dice start rolling, and actions get declared, and it's combat.
Eric Okra
is just fighting.
I never do that, but what I have ended up doing in the past is the group will get to a climatic encounter. Mm-hmm. And I cut the game off and I say, all right, we're getting straight into it next week because I know this is a major event. We don't have time for it right now. Or I just want to have it be suspenseful.
Yeah.
And so we put it off for the next week. And so next week starts, we sit down at the table, we pull out the character sheets. There's the battle mat, go.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been times when that ended up taking the entire night.
Yeah.
And that's really painful, even for me. You know, 4 hours of nothing but a single map combat is...
Yeah.
Well, your ass starts to hurt by the end of it.
Getting back on realism, do you think that realism can bog a game down? Not consistency. I'm talking like, even if the details are internally consistent, mm-hmm. can you just have way too many and too much?
Yes. Yes, especially if you have an engineer in your game.
I was actually going to try to steer back to this point, too, because this is something that we sort of hit on in the past. But talking about realism in a sense of real life kind of mm-hmm. actions in the game and keeping it as close to like real life as possible. What level of that do you guys like to have in your games that you run? And conversely, what do your players generally like to see? Like, how much realism do they want?
I was sitting there thinking that it's by genre, but really it's not. When Johan said, well, if you have an engineer in your game, because I was thinking, you know, sci-fi probably suffers from detail overload more than any other genre. And then he's like, oh, yeah, if you have an engineer in your game, I'm like, oh, well, absolutely. I'm like, well, wait a minute.
What
if
I've had people sit at my table and calculate how long it would take a sword to reach the ground, dropped from a flying dragon overhead, because somebody was trying to toss the sword down so that the fighter could have it in the fight that he was in the middle of. And they're like, okay, well, you know, this would take it 9.8 meters per second squared. He's approximately 1,800 feet in the air. And
but Aquaman, so that would take
12.3 seconds. So he's not going to get it for three more rounds.
I have been in games, people have started whipping out the trig, and it's just like, whoa. But I was also thinking like a medieval game, even like a medieval fantasy game, you have a history major in there?
Oh, whoa, it's awful.
Yeah. I mean, you start talking about, you come up to the castle, and then it's just like, Oh, well,
I mean, essentially what that is you're getting setting lawyered. Yeah, and your setting just happens to be history.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And setting lawyers are awful regardless.
You have a poli-sci degree.
And history.
And history.
But my point is, I never was like, well, this is an Edwardian castle, and clearly it's an Enterprise setting.
Like, I don't know what he just said either. So
something about an Edwardian castle, yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Good luck transcribing that one.
Yeah. Incomprehensible. Parentheses, incomprehensible, close parentheses.
That'll be awesome. Can't wait to read that.
John Bot says, beep, 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 beep. Everyone dies.
It doesn't really matter what setting, what genre. You're always going to get people who can just out-detail you.
Mm-hmm.
Or if no one can out-detail you and you're really proud of that fact, then you're that guy.
Yeah.
Don't be that guy. There is a certain responsibility of the GM to play within the box and to give a reasonable amount of detail about the setting.
And now I will lay down one caveat to what we're talking about, which is if you have an entire group of that guy.
Yeah.
If the entire group is that guy and they're all it would take three rounds for the sword to reach the ground. He's absolutely right. Hell, awesome. Yeah, go with it.
Yeah.
You know, if that's what's making everyone have a good time, then
all the professors
unhear what we said in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah. But all the professors of the medieval history department in a university get together for their weekly medieval D&D game.
God, that would be awesome. I would love to sit in on that game.
Be the guy who refuses to use a map, and every time one of his kobolds is within charging distance, it's 29 feet, but every time you are, it's 31 feet. That's infuriating.
That is infuriating.
That is when fast and loose with the rules.
That is somebody who should receive a D4 through their left eye.
Yes, indeed.
But I also think a little bit of this is on the players, too. Besides the fact that the players need to, within their character's sphere of influence, they need to come up with details that the GM isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But also, they need to kind of forgive some details, too, or even help the GM with details. If a GM's describing a scene, it depends on how much narrative control the players have and what kind of game you're playing, but it's okay to add those details, but also don't overload the GM with details as well. Don't overload the GM with, you know, my sword is falling at 3 to the pi squared feet per second or whatever. But don't
look on Pat's face.
Yeah, the math guys. Oh my God. Oh, math is wrong. Math is never wrong. How could you make math wrong? But
I think it was the applying pi to
I was trying gravity. To imagine maybe the sword was on a string and it was making an arc through the air under the dragon, and then pi could maybe get involved somehow.
You can't tell me that you haven't heard weirder plans.
Oh, no. I probably had that plan. That sounds exactly like something I would do.
The dragon pendulum strafing maneuver was conceived by Thorax the Black in 382 after victory.
Yeah. I was notorious for that for years of playing. And I was one of those players who, you look at the back of my character sheet, there is an extremely lengthy and detailed itemized list of what my character has down to the last piece of chalk and fishing hook. Yeah. And, you know, oh, look, there's an undead hiding in the bottom of this lake. We can't get to the bottom. I know, I've got 50 feet of rope, some grappling hooks, some fishing line. I'm just going to whip this together and, hey, look, it's a dragnet with hooks. Toss it in.
Ugh. So anyway,
I miss Dragnet.
The player help with detail can also be something like you're playing a sci-fi game, you're the crew of a ship, the GM really isn't Bill Nye Science Guy, and to him the ship is a metal box hurtling through space
with a hamster in it and a bunch of hippo mercenaries.
No, never. Yes. Never, ever that.
Approach spell jamming speed.
No. But
set hyperdrive coordinates for totally f***ing stupid.
You know, you
into the phlogiston.
You can come up
loves
with
me some spell jammer.
Oh. God, I hate it. I want to spell jam it into my eyelid until I die because I hit my brain.
You know, say you are the science guy and the GM isn't. Come up with the ship's FTL drive. Come up with the science stuff behind the ship. And give it to the GM or the other players or make that part of the truth and the detail of the world.
Then build and market your FTL drive. Become a billionaire.
Drive a Porsche.
I felt really smart because I was reading about the successor to the Hubble telescope that we're going to put up. And I forget what it's called. But
the mass array?
I don't even remember what it is. It's an IR telescope, and they're not putting it in low orbit. They're putting it at whatever one of those points are called.
A Lagrange point.
Yeah, I read that, and I was like, wait a minute. That's a pirate jump in Battletech. I know what a Lagrange point is. I'm so smart. I know science.
Battletech.
I refuse to order the jump ship to go to a Lagrange point because you'll disintegrate if you screw it up by like a micrometer.
You're really putting that science degree to work.
I know.
Oh, it's political science.
Indeed. Yes. Whatever. Yes. I'm in charge of this lance now. I choose where we jump. Why? Because Wayne can't not get kicked in the head to death.
That's true.
Everything is Wayne's fault.
So do you guys have anything to say on detail? Realism?
Because this is just really getting creepy with Chad and I sitting here agreeing with each other for 20 minutes.
I know. I'm really disturbed.
You guys need to talk.
I think you guys have found the one Fear the Boot opinion, which is do as much as is enjoyable and no more. And also don't give contradictory rulings when the player is relying on them to do something. Or
be it rules or be it just setting detail and info.
Yeah.
I think another good thing is, it's especially important, is the GMs should do this. They should put this detail in there, but the players should also do some of the work too. The players should help out with the detail.
Yeah. Yeah. All I'm thinking of as you guys tell these stories as they regard to rule dependency, and I wasn't even there, is Gnarlgate. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but apparently, Chad, you had most of the town's militia be like third level fighters, just hordes and hordes and hordes of them.
I don't even remember what level they are. But
yeah, but at any point, they were classed fighters. All of them were, and not just level one. And Dan went into it thinking that, you know, this is D&D. The militia are
level one warriors,
if not level one commoners.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe the sergeant of arms has a level or two of fighters.
Which is why I gave Dan.
Right. And you backed it up and explained it to each other. But yeah, keep the verisimilitude within the system as well as within itself. You could conceivably have a town where the entire citizenry had a level of fighter, but it would have to be like situated at the mouth of hell and fighting off demon invasions every 6 hours.
Yeah.
Sunnydale?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be awesome. I would play that.
You know, I'm sure that exists.
I'm sure it does.
Are you guys talking about a Buffy the Vampire?
Yes.
Yeah.
There is a Buffy the Vampire RPG.
Yeah.
There's an Angel one too, I believe. Or maybe that's just an expansion.
Probably. Same vein.
The only Buffy that I liked had Pee Wee Herman in it because it had the best death scene in the film ever.
That was a good death scene. I'll give you that.
Poor Paul Rubens. Anyone could have been caught doing that.
I'm trying to think if there's any Joss Whedon products that don't have an RPG with them. And the only one I'm coming up with is
Dr. Horrible.
Oh, maybe not. Maybe the Dollhouse
does. There's no way Dollhouse does. Forum explodes. Actually, I made a Dollhouse game.
They should. That'd be great.
Control your show, Pat.
Oh, it's fine.
We got a show.
It's controlled.
What do you guys think about when realism and internal consistency clash? If what is realistic would not be consistent with the rest of the rules that are going on.
Like what?
Yeah.
I read an article because there's this wank in D&D because D&D has so many wanks on it where, you know, old D&D, I don't think the new stuff has it, but old D&D had, if you played a female, you took a stat hit to strength, I think.
You had a stat cap. Yeah.
Yeah. Stat cap. Because if you take the average woman and the average man has a tendency to be able to bench press more than the average woman, thus they put a strength cap on it. And people cried sexism, and they cried this and that. And this guy wrote an interesting article on it. It's just like, it is absolutely ridiculous to have this cap, but it isn't ridiculous for sexism reasons. It's ridiculous because you're flinging fireballs all over the place. You have these dragons flying in the air. Who cares? It's like, have you seen an anime recently where a schoolgirl can punch through a tank? Why not?
She is a master of waifu.
Well, there you go.
Well, and it's all about the point that you are the exceptional people in this world that you're playing in. Mm-hmm. You're not average.
Yeah.
So right there,
which is why Chris wanted to do 5d6 drop 2 for this Pathfinder game. It's like, what? Like, yeah, I want to do 18d6 drop 5 and just add them up and slip them in, but damn.
The most outrageous character creation system that I ever came across for D&D, this was back when we were like 14, was a 6x6 grid made up of 66 drop 3 for each entry, and then you pick your choice of vertical, horizontal, I think diagonal.
Oh, wow.
But I know it was you picked your choice of vertical or horizontal. And then I think we also let you swap one with an adjoining column.
Holy crap.
Yeah, it was 18, 18, 16, 17, 18.
Yeah, I mean, why
18.
Not just play 18 the 18-ing? I'm 18, I don't know what I want. It was. Yeah, it I got was, a theme song for that game.
It was awesome. That game was fantastic.
I bet.
Sounds awful.
You are the exemplar. So, you are the exceptional.
So in a game like that,
but nobody has 18 in everything.
It's pretty much
except
a
like
combat
Alan
game.
Rickman.
No, actually, it wasn't. Believe it or not, I mean, okay. There was combat in it. Sure. There was actually a lot of combat in it, sure. But it was mostly between the players.
Oh,
we
there
killed
you go.
Each other a lot.
See, well, okay, maybe not in that game, but you talk about these games where people cheat on their characters and just make these super statted out characters. The whole crew is super statted out. It's a Monty Hall campaign. They have this tons of loot. What do you fight at that point? You fight things that can give you a challenge that are at that power level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you fight things that you can easily crush and it's just look how cool I am, Mom. But let's...
I think if you gave yourself 4 18s and 2 16s, you're okay with just crushing everything that comes in front of you.
Well, the other thing too is, like in the example you gave, if everybody in there is cheated that same way, everybody is statted that high, then really it's an equal playing field,
because if everyone
everybody cheated, so really it doesn't matter because you're all equal anyway.
You have to, the GM is going to set something on you that will be a challenge for you to take, but isn't necessarily going to kill you outright. I mean, it
does actually become a very big problem.
Yeah.
Especially if you are the sort of DM who is tied to the rules.
Yeah.
Because almost everything is badly balanced between offense and defense as it is.
Yes.
And when you up the offense level of the party, they almost never get a survivability that goes up as much as their offense does with high stats.
Yeah, can't get survivability without class levels.
What we always used to call it was eggshells with hammers. That's what the party became once it started reaching high power levels and high levels in general. And you got tons of magic items. It's a bunch of walking eggshells, all of which wield war hammers. Mm. And whoever swings first wins. Mm. And it really does become a little bit meh.
Yeah.
But if you're
extend spell haste,
rules waving DM, you can work around it. There's ways to do it. I've done it before when I've worked myself into a corner like that with a group, and there are ways around it, but you really have to do a tap dance around the rules to make it happen.
Well, you've already tap danced around the rules to make these characters in the first
not necessarily in many game systems, D&D especially, characters naturally become that way.
Yeah,
over time,
it's a progression.
And
the progression is only up.
And in fact, almost all systems I can't think of any exceptions actually where survivability increases alongside offensive power. Maybe vampire,
because it's like an MMO.
They do get pretty tough to kill as they get up in power levels. But for the most part, you get phenomenal cosmic power, but you take 3 arrows to the chest and you're still dead.
I mean, it's like an MMO, right? I mean, you're fighting this monster and you're doing 3,000 points of damage and he's doing 300 points of damage to you.
Right.
Well, how is that really effectively any different than 6 months before that when you were fighting a different monster and you were doing 300 points of damage to it and it was doing 100 points of damage to you? It gets
more DPS is how it's different.
It gets to
More dots.
It gets to a point to where the numbers that are popping over your head are just bigger. And then when you open up your character sheet, the numbers are just bigger.
7 years of WoW.
Yeah.
And all that happened the entire time
is numbers got more zeros behind
more dots.
And that's how I see that the high level D&D is just the numbers are just getting bigger.
And there are...
And so are the kill effects and the power word kills and the illusion kills and the evocation kills and the necromancy kills. And
most games are the same way. It gets
polymorph.
To a point and it's all rocket tag. But
it's rocket tag.
And there are ways around it. And that's a struggle for any high power game to run one, is trying to make it be interesting and not be rocket tag.
Because I think a lot of people enjoy leveling up. It's just like they start with a weaker character, and through hard work and dedication in playing the game, the character gets stronger, are rewarded along that path of, oh, I got a cool ability. Oh, now I have two cool abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, you hit that point to where you stop being cool and it's just bigger numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I think that that transition point is where a lot of people maybe stop their campaign. It's like, okay, well, I have gotten, and I'm just talking mechanically. I'm not talking a story or anything like that. You know, it's like you get to that point to where it's just like, okay, I've achieved the cool stuff. I have the cool stuff. Now all my cool stuff is just putting more zeros behind the number.
And the only way to really avoid that in a game system, I think, is to design the character advancement system in such a way that characters advance outward, not upward.
Yes.
Ars Magica comes to mind. Yes, you can continue to vote everything into E6 D&D is another.
Mm-hmm.
You can continue to vote everything into one specific category if you want, but it's designed in such a way as to encourage you to instead get a wider skill set rather than improving your existing one. And then you can do more things, not one thing better.
Yeah.
So,
and I think it would be cool too if, and I'm sure that there are games out there that do this, is that as you level up, it's like, well, I can get a +1 to sword swinging, or I can get a follower, or I can get title or some lands or something.
You just
like
need to
this.
Be a 9th level second edition fighter. You get +1 to sword swing and followers and a title.
Yeah, see, you know, it's just that they're giving you too much.
Okay, then you could be a 6th level 3rd edition D&D character, in which case you can either take weapon focus +1 to your sword,
right,
or you can take leadership. Gain a follower.
There you go.
See,
they did that right.
Third edition is the perfect system, just like I always said.
That's Johan at feartheboot.com.
Oh, damn it. That address exists now.
Yes,
that's terrible.
Yes, it does.
No, I haven't checked mine since.
That's one way to handle it. Yes, absolutely. All righty. Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for us tonight.
Well, you moderated the out of this
one. Oh, I know. I did. It was just a force to behold.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Pat moderated this episode like the Somalian government moderates its coastline.
You mean multinational navy?
Indeed. Yes, exactly.
No, this is the months of Dutch hostages being taken. Yeah. The multinational navy is on its way.
Yes.
Jumping to us with an FTL drive it can't explain.
The Dutch never can.
Indeed.
Everybody, y'all, you know what? That's it. We're done.
Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. See you next week.
Wow. Sorry, Dan.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.